Okay, tonight is, welcome everybody. Tonight is January 22nd, 2022. Tonight is the sixth class, and tonight we're just going to be, I'd like to discuss about the, just what Poland was in general. In the, what was Jewish, I guess more the Jewish life, what was Jewish life like? So this is a little bit of a background. Just, we spent some time on the governments, the kings. We spent some time on some of the great rabbis, and now just maybe a little bit about what the people lived like a little bit. So we did mention this last time. We have the Jews came in the 900s, but in the 1200s they had the first a charter from the kings saying that they could live there. And everything will be fine, and we'll be all, the certain rights that were given to Jews, something that was really unheard of in all parts of Europe. It establishes Jewish autonomy, and Jews immigrate seeking better conditions. And then in the 1300s and 1400s, they were invited by local rulers, and also with pogroms from Germany and France. Everybody, as you can see, they just moved east, and this is where it was. We mainly spent time in the 1500s, because then already by the early 1500s that the Poland became a lot stronger. Thousands of Jews were moving there. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but the language, since most of the Jews came from Germany, at least in the beginning, that was where it was closer. So customs, Ashkenazic customs, all these different customs, they ended up coming from Germany. That's where also Yiddish, where Yiddish started from in Germany, and that became the language of Poland, and many Ashkenazim, and also the idea of a kahal. Yes, Terry?
Was the Jewish community settled in one particular city or town?
No, not really. First of all, this is more Poland than Lithuania is over here. Lithuania and Poland are going to eventually be one country, so to speak. I mean, it sort of kept their different identities, but the king of one was really the king of the other. It was it was run by the king. But they know they moved to very, very different cities in Poland. There were bigger cities where Jews were, Krakow, which should have been down here, Krakow and Lublin and Warsaw. These were different major cities that Jews moved into. But they're going to move all over, and eventually, what's in the beginning, we'll just talk about a little bit later, but they're eventually going to move into these like little shtetls.
But Warsaw, the capital then, as it is now?
Right, yeah. No. It became the capital of Warsaw, I'm not sure when. But in early on, I don't believe it was Warsaw. It was, I don't remember the name, I think something with a K. See this, I'm not sure, but it eventually became Warsaw, but, okay. It mainly became the German Minhagim, became the main Minhagim of Poland, because the overwhelming, at least for sure in the beginning, of the German Jews came there with them in Hagen. Now, by the 1500s, we had 50,000 Jews in Poland. But the Poland was very... the Jews, when they first came there, they had some sort of an affinity, some sort of a love for Poland. The Pinchas of Koretz, I think he says, the Polish exile was less bitter for anyone than anywhere else. The Marsha, he says, Sforim Haim, the Abashta Havave Leka Galuta, which I guess they mean, the Marsha writes that they forgot they were in Galus, here in Babel, not Babel, in Poland. And of course, the This is more of a famous Polin, stands for Po Lin. The Po here, Lin, we will live. And in the very beginning, and this really was that way for the first 150 years. From 1500s, early 1500s to the 1640s, it was Jewish life was. Growing, and it was very hospitable to Torah and everything about the about Poland, and that's the way it was. That's the way it was felt. After the Smolensk's rebellion, 1648, things changed, and Poland became overnight or became just a totally different Poland. Between 1500 and 1648, during these 150 years, so the population went from, let's say, 30 or 50,000 to 500,000 Jews. By 1648, it is clearly the largest Jewish community in the world, is in Poland. And, you know, the rest of the world in the 1600s, 1500s are still exiling their Jews, and pogroms and blood libels and host desecrations, and where else was there to go? So there were mainly two places, especially in 1492, it was the Spanish Inquisition, followed by 4 years later was Portugal, and there was some point in the early 1600s that there was only Jews in Germany in like two or three places. I think Vienna was one of them, and maybe one other city protected their Jews. But it was just, so where else did they go except they went to Poland?
And there are records of Sephardic communities in Poland?
Yeah, there are. As a matter of fact, there's a book that Baruch Epstein, he was a nephew of the Nitziv. Actually, it came out, there was an Oxford book called My Uncle the Nitziv. Somehow it got banned. You have it? Okay, I think I have some copy somewhere too.
When did Ashkenazim start?
They started early way in the 900s. But they didn't become, you know, people started visiting and started to settle. And then, you know, the rulers in the thousands, 1100s, 1200s, they realized how vital the Jews are for the economy, for building up the community, and they invited them and they gave them charters.
Did it start as a movement, or was it there?
Well, it was an invitation. It was an open country. They became Christian very late in the game. They were like the last European country to become Christian, so they didn't have as much bias as countries that were Christian for 400, 500 years. And the rulers, they protected the Jews, they gave them rights, and it was very hospitable. So Jews just realized, look, why am I here in Germany? Why am I in France? Why am I, you know, in all these countries, and I'm getting exiled, and I don't have rights and everything. Let me go to Poland. And slowly but surely, people started moving. And once people stopped moving, you know? We could just see it here down here in Florida is the same thing. Once people are moving, we just see more people are moving and moving, and that's really what happened from the 1500s all the way through. In the early 1500s, we mentioned in one of the previous lectures, it was a person by the name of Rav Yaakov Palach who came to Poland, and he was able to start a yeshiva movement that like was amazing, and yeshivas started to flourish, and he had a certain type of a learning, a pilpul type of learning that excited the masses, and people were coming. I mean, the pilpul learning we also mentioned had its disadvantages. We don't learn like that today, but it filled the yeshivas, and you know, the yeshivas were filled, and rabbanim were filled, and Torah was all around. We'll speak more about that soon. By the 1600s, mid-1600s, 500,000 Jews, it was like clearly the largest community. It was also Jews were moving to the Ottoman Empire, to the Turks. That's where else the Jews were moving. During this time, the Turkish Empire was growing and growing and growing as well. So you had the Polish Empire, and to the south you had the Turkish Empire, and many of the Sephardim were going to the Turkish Empire, more so than to Poland. Poland was more to the north, and Ashkenazim were going east already. As you can see here, it's like where Germany is. It's all the way north. Under here, Slovakia, down here would be Turkey. And you know, when the Sephardim came from Spain, and they came across the Mediterranean Sea, if they can get to the Turks opened up their country to them the same as Poland opened up their countries to the Jews. The Turks opened up their countries to the Sephardim, and it was hard to get there because you have to get halfway across the world. But once they got to the Turks, the Sultan said, "You come to us and you can do whatever you want. You want to learn Torah, you want to help, you'll help us with our economy, you'll help us build the empire." And these were the two hospitable countries at the time. Just you see how Hashem always makes a place for the Jews. You know, he makes a place for the Jews. They're thrown out of one country, and there's another country that will take them in. This is all, right? Ma'aseh Avos Simon Labanim, Yaakov Avinu, when he was coming to Esav, what did he do? How did he prepare for war? He split his family up into two families, two groups. He says, if one gets attacked, you know, the other one will escape. And that's for all of our history, with maybe a short one or two times in history, the Jews were always in different countries. One of the times that they were all under one king was Ahasuerus, Purim. And had Haman's decree, there was nowhere else to go. That's it. Ahasuerus had all of the Jews under his empire. There was also another time, I think, the Byzantine, Justinian, I think he was the king at the time. He also, at one short amount of time, he had all the Jews under him. But shortly after, that's when the Muslims came out of nowhere. And they took over, you know, and that's it. And they took over half the world. So you had, again, half the Jews under the Christians, half the Jews under the Muslims. And we've really been like this all through our history. Okay, so where we we all, Poland also followed the German model of a kahal, which was a group of people that would take care of the community. I guess we sort of have that too, but if you had in the shtetl, you had this group of people, and they were in charge of everything from the shul to the chevra kadisha to the dealing with the taxes and dealing with the government around them and dealing with the noble. Whatever issues had to be taken care of, it was the kahal. The kahal took care of the group. Okay, now I want to talk about what also happened. Very, very interesting, very fascinating. Something that took place in Poland that really gave a lot of strength to Torah in Poland. And that was something called the Council of the Four Lands. At certain times it was called the Council of the Three Lands, sometimes it was called Council of the Five Lands. But this was an unbelievable setup, which it was established in 1580, but there was the beginnings of it was a lot earlier. I'll show you a few things earlier. It was a governing body, it ruled over everything of all the Jews. And it was based in Lublin, and it made up of representatives from every single community. And it was also the liaison between the Jewish people and the government, the king, the nobles. They knew who to go to. It was somebody who would represent the Jews. They didn't have to speak to individual Jews and individual communities. There was this governing body. And the way as you can see, and it was dissolved in 1764. So for like almost 200 years, this was the governing body.
Why did it dissolve?
There was a lot going on in Poland at the time. In the 1700s, there was a time where Poland ceased to exist. I think it was around that time where there was war, Russia took a piece, and Prussia took a piece, and Sweden took a piece, and it was a lot going on from foreign countries. Poland became very, very weak. Its strength in that it was very democratic. They didn't strengthen the king, and because of that, they were taken over by foreign countries. And they didn't become a country again until after, I think it was after World War I, right? After World War I, when they redrew the map, Poland became a country again. This is a quote from Rav Nosson Not to Hanover. Rav Nosson Not to Hanover, he wrote a book about, he wrote a sefer, Yavin Bensula, I forgot the name of the book. I may have it down here. He wrote about the Tachvatat. He wrote about about Tachvatat and the false Mashiach Shabtai Tzvi. So he wrote it, but he describes what would happen at the fair. Now the Council of the Four, the Council of the Four Lands, they met twice a year. They met at the Lublin Fair, and they met at the Zaslav Fair. And twice a year they met, and there were these big fairs in Poland. And all businessmen, that was the place to be. You went to the fair, anybody that needed business went there, the yeshivas went there, everybody went there. Not only the Jews, but the Goyim also. It was a major fair, but the Jews were, that was a major part for them. Afterwards, this is what he calls, afterwards Rav Shiva, together with the students of his yeshiva, both the older and younger, would travel to the fair. In the summer, they would travel to Zaslav and Yaroslav in Galicia, and in Lvov and Lublin in the winter. At the fair, there were hundreds of Rosh Yeshivas, many thousands of Bachurim, and myriads of young students. They were in attendance, and non-Jewish merchants, and plentiful as the sea, sand and the seashore. From one world to the next, people would come to the fair. From all over, they would come. So this is how Poland, this is the way Poland existed. One who had a son or a daughter to marry off, would travel there, would make a match. Each one would find what they're looking for in a proper mate. Hundreds of matches would be made at each fair, and at a time, thousands. The country of Poland was like Jerusalem before its destruction. When courts were set up in every city, and if one refused to be judged by the court of his city, he went to the nearest court, and if he refused to be judged by the nearest court, he went before the great court. Now, there were a few great courts in bigger cities, and then the major court, which was... Thus, in the capital of Ostrog, there was a great court for Volhynia in the Ukraine. And in the capital of Lvov, there was another. There was a court for Little Russia. There were many communities, each had a great court of its own. And if the important communities had a dispute between themselves, they would let themselves be judged by the head of the Council of the Four Lands, who would be in session twice a year. One leader would be chosen from each important community. Added to these were six Gaonim from the land of Poland, and these were known as the Council of the Four Lands. The representatives of the Four Lands had sessions twice in the year at the fair in Lublin between Purim and Pesach, and the fair in Yaroslav in the month of Av or Elul. The leaders of the Four Lands resembled the Sanhedrin. They had jurisdiction over all the Jews of the Kingdom of Poland, with power to issue injunctions, binding decisions, and impose penalties at their discretion. Every difficult case was submitted to them for trial. To make the task easier for themselves, representatives of the four lands would make special judges of each land, who were called district judges, who tried civil suits while criminal cases, disputes over priority of chazaka, and other difficult cases were tried by the leaders of the four lands. So they had an entire hierarchy. You know, courts were all over the land, only like this week's parsha. You know, Yisrael told Moshe, you can't do it yourself, and he made courts of the thousands, courts of the hundreds, courts of the tens, and that's how it was there too. Every city had its own court, Bigger cities had a bigger court, and now if things needed to be judged by the real experts, if it was community against community or hard cases that needed the highest court of the land, so then that's it. You had to wait to the fairs, which was twice a year, and the major court was open for. Would take the case if they had the six of the greatest gedolim and representatives from all other cities. Never was a dispute brought to the Gayim. And if it was, they were punished and chastised. Every community also appointed men in charge of weights and measures and other business dealings so that everything would be conducted according to truth and worthiness. This is it. Yavein HaMetzula. That's the Sefer of Rav Nassim Natan Hanover, who made most of his sefer is about the Tach V'Tat. But he brings down, and this is what Poland was before the war, before Tach V'Tat. Okay, this is something where there must have been some sort of a vad of three lands of something earlier, because this is in the year 1559. So in the year 1559, the printing press first came out in 1480s. It didn't hit the Jewish world till the beginning of the 1520. Then already it became, the Jews became interested in it. So in the 1500s, they were printing up the Gemaras. So, but it was very, very costly. So, it's not like you could, today you print up a whole shas, and relatively it's not so expensive. So this is what they decided to do in order to help the printing of Gemaras. With the full agreement of all the Gaon and Rosh Yeshivas of the three lands, again, this is the three lands, Poland, Russia, and Lithuania. Again, this is 1560, so it's about 20 years before the official Council of the Four Lands. They instituted a binding enactment that every yeshiva throughout the land should study one tractate after the next as they're being printed. With the help of Hashem, in order to spread Torah in Israel and in order to strengthen our hands in this holy work, this was the opening inscription in the Talmud printed in Lublin in 1559. So there was even some sort of a vad earlier, 20 years earlier, that decided to say, look, all the yeshivas, let's all learn this Masechta. This way, the new volume that came out that we just printed, they'll be able to sell it out, and then they'll be able to make a new volume. And when that new volume comes out, we're going to all study that volume. Again, this is also another something that came out. This is from the Ramah. The Ramah writes certain things that they made certain conditions that one court, one city can't take another court. Another city to another court. It was sent a system of when you can go to take them to another court. Sometimes already elapsed since two leaders of the respective cities, together with their constituents, stood before the leaders of the land and negotiated an agreement that members of a larger city would not have any power over members of a smaller city to summon them before their courts, nor any form of authority over them. Again, just because you're a bigger city and you may have a bigger court, you can't use that as an advantage over a small city. The only exception would be in situations leading to potential general libel, which could bring an additional tax, or if it's a blood libel, situations like this, then it could be done. But in general, just because a smaller city is in court with a bigger city, this bigger city cannot force the small city. And again, this was from the Ramah in the year 1559. And, also another in 1559, who showed me the proofs which he wrote, the judges of the three lands, it was not effective because, and they ruled in, okay, whatever. Again, another showing that there was these courts. Again, another thing we chose, this is how they, again, in 1569, we chose nine heads of the land and three rabbis. In every fair in Lublin, three of the heads, together with one of the rabbis, shall sit in session to oversee general welfare so that there should not be no breach in our communities, neither caused by us or the government. They should stand to seek common good and to punish evildoers, rebels, and those who steal and lie. both Jews and non-Jews alike. So the name of heaven that should be the desecrated. Again, this is Yosia, such a, how they were so careful and how they set up the system so nice, so well, that Torah is the law of the land, and this is the way we were internally able to keep the to keep honesty and keep the laws. Another one, we also enacted that at every fair, they should choose three judges to judge between the fellow Jews in all cases, major or minor. Their decisions will be binding, and they will have the power to judge all who come before them, whether it's an issue of a large sum or a small sum. Again, the same idea. So they had to appear by Lublin. Again, this is all before the Council of the Four Lands. Again, whoever shall willfully not listen to them will be excommunicated and subject to all the previous listed forms of punishment. Being excommunicated in the 1500s was a lot harsher than today. Today, who really has the power, and you can go from one place to the other. There, it wasn't so mobile, and the Kahal, they had control over everything. You can't be buried, you can't be married, you can't go to a shul. It was all, so excommunication there meant a lot more than it was now. We have granted the petition elders of Tikton. Okay, same idea again. This is a little bit later. Okay, I wanted to say this is a very, very famous legend that happened among the Jewish people, and it happened in 1584, I believe it is. And basically, there's something called like King for a Day. I don't know if everybody heard this, where there was a Jew who was a king for a day. It's a legend. And the way the legend started was there's a prince, a Lithuanian prince by the name of Nicholas Radziwill, yeah?
I think he might have been related to one of the Mahatinas of the Kennedy family.
Of the?
Kennedy family.
Kennedy? Okay.
Yeah.
But this is in the 1500s. So, like, okay, could be. Kennedys are much later. But in any case, so the way the story goes, he wanted to do penance for many atrocities he had committed while a young man. He went to Rome, and this is the way we have the story. You'll see how it is recorded by the non-Jews. But the way we have the story is, so he went to Rome in order to consult the Pope, as he wanted to do tshuva. So he goes to his Rebbe, the Pope, and he says, "What should I do? I want to do tshuva." So the Pope advised him to dismiss all the servants and live for a few years as a wandering beggar. And after the expiration of the period prescribed, so he did it. He left and he wandered, and he was, you know, when he finished, okay. So now Radziwill found himself destitute and penniless in the city of Padua, Italy. And now he's saying, all right, he's a prince. He's like, you know, could have been in line for the kingship. And he's found himself in Padua, and he says, hey, can somebody help me out? But he looks like a beggar, and he sounds like a beggar, and nobody's giving him the time of day. He's stuck in Padua, like without any money. So he ends up, okay, no, just there, yeah, right, you're the prince, right, we got you. He finally decided to appeal to Samuel Judah Catanel in Bogen, the rabbi of Padua. The latter received him with respect, treated him kindly, furnished him with ample means to return to his native country in a manner befitting a high rank. So he believed him, he took him in. You're a noble, sure, fine, here. Let me give you money, okay. When the time for departure came, the prince asked the rabbi how he could repay him for his kindness. The rabbi then gave him a picture of his son, Shaul, who years before had left for Poland, and he asked the prince to try to find the boy in one of the many yeshivas in that country. He says, look, I have a son. He's learning one of the yeshivas in your country there. And that's it. You want to go? Send and say hello to him. Give him a shalom aleichem for me. All right. So he did. The prince did not forget the request. I guess he was very touched, honored. And upon returning to Poland, he went to every yeshiva until he found, discovered Shaul in that of Breslavas, which is, we know it as Brisk. It was in Lithuania, one of the big four cities, Brisk. He was so captivated by the brilliancy and depth of Shaul's intellect that he took him to his own castle, provided for all his wants, and supplied him with all the possible needs for study and investigation. The nobleman who visited Rezlili's court marveled at the wisdom and learning of the young Jew, and thus the fame of Shaul spread throughout Poland. So he had like a sponsor, sponsored this young boy, Shaul. Anyway, well, when King Stephen Batory died in 1586, the people of Poland were divided into two factions, the Zamuskis and the Zabrowskis. Okay, I guess that's what they were. They were quite a number of candidates for the throne, but the contending parties could not agree. There existed a law, which, okay, that's what, that makes this whole story possible, that which stipulates that the throne may not be remain unoccupied for any length of time. In that case, the electors could not agree upon a candidate, an outsider should be appointed rex pro tempore. Now, again, you want to get somebody who's going to be a temporary king, right? You got to figure out who's the real king going to be. But you got to be careful who you put in as a temporary king, because your temporary king may just get and say, oh, this is, you know, I kind of like this. You know, he's not going to give that up, and now you're going to have other problems. Okay, so this honor was then, or the way we have it, the honor was then offered to Radziwill, but he refused, saying that there was a man who belonged to neither party and whose wisdom and goodness was far superior to anyone else. That man possessed one very slight shortcoming, which would have been that he's a Jew, which could have been an advantage because they knew that the Jews... By the way, that was why Jews were very, very sought after in Poland and also many places, because everybody realized Jews weren't interested in becoming king. You know, if you get somebody who you try to build up and you have him helping you, eventually he'll say, what do I need you for? I could be king myself, or I could be noble. But the Jews were not like that. They were totally loyal, because there was no way that they would even think of being king or noble or anything. So the man possessed only one slight shortcoming, and if the guy would make the lectures unanimous, he would acquaint them with his name, and they did. Accordingly, Saul's name was solemnly proposed, and through great enthusiasm and shouts of long live King Shaul, Wall was elected to his high official. The name Wall was given to him from the German word Wall, meaning election. Traditions disagree as to the length of his reign. Some say he ruled one night only. Others make it a few days. All, however, I agree that Shaul succeeded in passing a number of very wise laws, among them to help the condition of the Jews in Poland. Although this story cannot be supported by any historical data, it gained a firm place in the belief of the people. That's it. We had the king for a day. There is something about Radziwill. The historian Gustav Karpeles writes that a historical kernel lies hidden in the legend. It rests on the Mikołaj Krzysztof, the orphan Radziwill, he said, made a widely publicized pilgrimage to Jerusalem. While returning, wrote Radziwill, he was attacked in Italy by robbers and was left in Ancona without any money. His pleas for help were ignored, all by except a Jewish merchant who alone believed his claim that he was a Polish noble. The merchant provided him with funds to return to Poland. Karpeles concluded that Radziwill's narrative is consistent with the narrative of the Jewish tale, and that the lone Jewish merchant who had helped the Radziwill was Samuel Judah Catanella Bogan, Shaul Wall's father. All right, so there is some outside corroboration about the about Shaul Wall. Okay, just a very interesting story that we have. Again, what else did the Council of Four Lands did? It defended against blood libel accusations. There were some kings that actually realized, they said, any blood libel accusation has to go to my court, right? And you need three Jews and three non-Jews to support such a claim. In other words, I guess in Poland, most of the people on top, they realized that the blood libels were false. It just, there was nothing to it. I mean, how many hundreds of if not thousands of Jews were killed, and Jews were exiled from cities all because of these false claims. And the government, the kings in Poland said, we're not going in for that. Anything of blood libels has to be taken to our court. It can't be done by a one of these like fake courts that they just, you know, rubber stamped that there was such a thing. So the council, this is something, one of the things that the council had to do, if there was any claims of a blood libel, they would get involved as well. They took action against the Folsom Sofer Lashatzai Tzvi and Jacob Frank. We probably will be continuing talking about Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi really never made his way to Poland. Poland was very, very affected by this, though, as the reports came up. But also Jacob Frank did have a following. He was somebody who followed in the steps of Shabtai Tzvi, even after Shabtai Tzvi died, and that did have an effect in Poland. They also supervised Jewish printings, and also they were the liaison between the community and the government. What did the Jews engage in? So the Jews engaged in a wide variety of commerce. The alliances of Poland landowning nobility invited Jews to settle the land. Jews were, mainly I think they had three main jobs. One was that they were the go-betweens. They were the ones that managed the estates of the nobles. So they were the ones that would go and, you know, get land leases, and they would have to collect money from all the people that were on the lands of the nobles. They were also into drinks. They had the exclusive rights for mashka, vodka, whatever, drinks, hard drinks, liquor, whatever it was that they sold then. And so they also had inns. Motels, inns where people would sleep. So that was their thing. They dotted the roads, and if anybody, you know, the Polish peasants would come into the inns and they would buy the drinks, and that's how the Jews, many Jews, would make their living. The third is with lumber. They were into lumber. So those were three. That's besides farming as well. I mean, farming as well. So these were the main Jewish occupations in Poland, at least up until more modern history, when the Jews moved to the cities, big cities more. again, same thing. Again, like we said before, the nobles did not have to worry about Jews taking over. Because the Jews was not there, they didn't want to take over. And they were very, very often, they were very, very loyal. Also, one other thing is that they also had international contacts. That, you know, if you wanted to start to do business in another country, how do you break in? So all you needed, you had your Jew, and he would call up his, you know, he'd go to the local shul over there, and he'd meet up with another Yid, and he'd just say, listen, where you're from? You're from Poland? You're from here? Do you know anybody that wants to buy a certain thing? Before you know it, they had a business contacts, and it was very, Jews were known to be able to do this. Okay, the shtetl started as a company town built on property of a Polish noble, communities built on lands to attract Jews. And there were many shtetlach that it was a Jewish majority. The Jews lived there. They would come. There was a market town where they would either come into the shtetl, or the shtetl would go nearby to the marketplaces. And that's, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, I guess. That's what we're, right? That's what we all think of when we think of the shtetl. Yes?
What we call the, what they call the shtetl then.
Right.
Was it bordered by...
lands, fields. It was probably a few groups of houses. They probably had a lot of land that they would farm. It was just
like they were locked into it at the time, right?
What do you mean locked into it? Could they move by another land? It was
mobility
was very hard. It wasn't like, you know, okay.
Could they move about freely?
In Poland, if they wanted to go, sure.
Yeah,
it wasn't like
during the time of the Nazis.
No, they were. You could move all over. I mean, it wasn't like it was easy for you to buy a house or move into some, you know, other place. You know, it could be in your shtetl. There were not that many houses, you know, and they were built internally, you know, as from the families that grew, but. It, It wasn't like, you know, you're gonna come from elsewhere and you're gonna buy a house. That probably wasn't as common. But but the landlords, these nobles were landlords, and they would open up. They would have these, you know, shtetlach. They would buy these, you know, start these like little villages for the Jews, and these were all over. These dotted the countryside. Germany, France, Spanish language did not divide. This is also very interesting. This is where, you know, there were some. This is something I remember hearing from Rabbi Wein. And Rabbi Wein says, in our history, the Jewish people they looked at different cultures. Some cultures we view as a superior culture, and some cultures we view as a inferior culture. Egypt, to the Jewish people, was viewed as an inferior culture. It says that the Jews did not change their clothing, they didn't change their speech, and that's it. They remained, you know, separate in Egypt. When they got to Canaan, so that they viewed Canaan as a superior culture, and the Torah had to constantly tell us not to follow what they do and not to do their avodah zarah, etc. Wherever we went, either, you know, in Western Europe, the Jews viewed Western Europe as a superior culture. And our mode of dress in Spain, Jews dress like the Spaniards. In Germany, they dress like Germans. In France, they dress like the Frenchmen. However, in Eastern Europe, they viewed Eastern Europe as an inferior culture. They did not want to look like the peasant. They did not want to speak like the peasant. And therefore, when it came to Eastern Europe, it was a totally different looking. The Jews, they kept their own identity. They kept their own language. Many people did not know Polish or Russian, for that matter. It just that wasn't part of it. They didn't have to speak it. They didn't. As things got more modern in the 1800s and 1900s, so things got different. But for the hundreds of years before, the Jews, they didn't care for Polish, and they spoke their Yiddish. And very often the non-Jews had to learn Yiddish, you know, to get along with the Jews. And the Jews did not want to look or dress like the Polish peasants or the Russian peasants. Therefore, their mode of dress was distinctly Jewish. And that was Eastern Europe. So Eastern Europe, they viewed their culture inferior, as opposed to Western Europe, that they looked more like the Jews viewed the culture as superior, or something that they could acknowledge, they would be part of, or dress like them and talk like them. And the decline of the shtetl was as things became more modern with railroads and big cities and more. Everything became more cosmopolitan in the 1800s, and the shtetls, they started to leave the shtetls as well. This is where I wanted to become spirit. Okay. As the yeshivas, we did mention this, is up until the 1500s, so anybody in Poland, where would they send their kids to yeshiva? They would send their kids to yeshiva to Germany. That's where. And starting the 1500s, they came up with their own yeshivas. And then into the late 1500s, 1600s, where the opposite happened. In Germany, they were sending the yeshiva boys were saying, going to Poland for the yeshivas. And Poland took over as the center of Jewish learning, or the center. We did all this. Okay, we mentioned some of these, and I do want to mention, I don't know if I'll mention it tonight, but there are maybe two or three other great, great rabbinic figures. We spoke about Shlomo Luria, we spoke about Ramosha Isselis, the Marshal, the Ramah, but there's others, the Kliyakar, the Bach, the Marshah. I have a few other rabbinim that maybe we'll just do a little biography of who they were. And these are some of the different yeshivas that became became big. The downfall again is going to be the 1648. Everything's going to change. That's with the Cossack Rebellion, and we're going to cover that. I don't know if we're going to cover that next, or we're going to cover Shabtai Tzvi, but that's what we're going to be covering. Just maybe a few more biographies of people, and then the next time we're going to start to talk about the Shabtai Tzvi and the Tach V'Tach. And then we're going to go to Poland, which is going to lead into the Hasidic movement. Because there's, and how the Hasidic movement was supposed to be like it was an answer to the void that was created from Tach V'Tach. Any questions? Okay. All right. All right then. Thank you so much.
Nice talk.
Thank you.